Okay, folks, we're just coming up on the half hour, so I'm going to mute all. And a reminder that everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment, and remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Tonight's deck, the contents of the chat window, and the audio track will go up on our website probably later on this evening, thanks to Alan's diligent work. And we have a lot of items on the agenda for tonight, so Alan, take it away.
We do, and thanks to everyone who responded to the call, because earlier in the week it was looking pretty dismal. Anyway, we have a lot of interesting things, so we'll start right off with a question that came in. Basically, this individual has a condominium group that needs a website and wanted a recommendation for a simple website that we can use. So the problem here is what you define as simple. Basically, my advice is to start with one of the free offerings, and the two that I've used and still do to some extent are WordPress and Google Sites. So if anybody has any other suggestions for a simple to use website development system, let us know in the chat or chat to us later on. In the meantime, I just remind you that Bridget and I did a presentation in 2021 on WordPress, and essentially the free version, WordPress.com. And the neat thing about this is you can develop either a website using web pages or a blog using web posts. And it has the capability to do both of those. There's a whole raft of different templates and themes that you can use to make the site or the web pages the way that you'd like them to look. There's a pretty easy to use graphical editor and lots of different tools to create and edit your pages or your postings. And of course, you have the ability to upload images and AV files and documents that you want to share with people. One of the good things about WordPress is it's a really well-established platform. It's been around for a long time. Lots of people are using it. And as a result, there's a lot of online help in terms of how-to pages and also lots of video tutorials on how to do various things. So although it's not, I would say it's not a particularly easy system to learn, there is a lot of help available to get you started. So it's pretty straightforward once you find the right kind of material that suits your purposes. One of the things about the free version, if you don't pay for any kind of account, WordPress will place adverts on your free web pages now and then. And of course it's freeware, so they're always encouraging you to update to a paid plan. But if you don't really know what you're doing, I think a free system is the way to start. And WordPress, in my view, has a lot of advantages. So I recommend that, and if anybody has any other thoughts, then we'll come to those later, I guess. Okay, anything else there, Chris?
Bob mentions that there are specialized website packages for many things, including condo groups and so forth, and he suggests just Googling for some. They're not usually free, but the costs are nominal.
Yeah, there's a lot of information out there. Okay, well, here's something that is free, and Chris is going to tell us all about symbols.
Yeah, I stumbled across this kind of cool on the Google Fonts website, where they have over 1,000 free, pretty good quality fonts available. They actually have symbols that are available as well. And you can go to their website, and I pasted the URL into the chat, and a sampling of some of the symbols that you can actually use that are on the screen there. There's over 2,860 free glyphs, each glyph being one symbol. And so if you're looking for these sorts of things to insert into a document or a presentation, kind of cool that you can actually download them as either a PNG or an SVG a graphic, or in actual fact, you can actually download a font file of these as well. Next.
Are they all black and white images, Chris?
Yes, they are. Yeah. Because they really are just fonts. So, mm-hmm. yeah. If you go to the site and you can search by keyword, or you can just scroll to browse through them if you want. Next. You can actually adjust the appearance of them. So you can, next. You can adjust the fill, so it'll either be blacked in or a white on the center part of the symbol. Next, you can adjust the stroke weight, which is the weight of the actual pen that draws the outline. Next, you can do finer adjustments to the stroke weight using what they call their grade. Next. And then optical size, it adjusts the stroke weight as the symbol size changes. And this is something particular to fonts in that as you scale things down, they tend to disappear if the stroke weight gets too small. And so that'll actually maintain a higher stroke size as you size the symbol down, which is kind of a cool effect. Next. So if you find something you want, you click on the symbol that you actually want. Next, and you'll get a settings panel open up. Next, and down at the bottom, you can download it either as an SVG, scalable vector graphics, or if your program can't handle SVG, you can download it as a PNG. You're probably better off with an SVG if it can actually handle it. It will get scaled without losing quality, so you can scale it up or down. And that's it.
Okay, and the next one is an item again for Chris.
Yeah, so this is something that Stuart Bruce actually brought up, and I offered to put together the slides for it. So he pointed out that the Microsoft Store has a built-in app updater. So if you actually go to the Store app, and then in the bottom left-hand corner, there's a library icon, and if you click on that, then you may or may not get a blue button at the top that says get update. So if it thinks everything is up to date, you won't get it. But if it thinks that there are some of your store apps, including the ones built into Windows that need updating, you will get that get updates, and you can click on that and update all your apps. And Stuart pointed out that when he went into the store for the first time, it updated 3 Microsoft apps, and I think you're lucky it was only 3 updates that came in. Next. So I pointed out at that point too that you can get faster updates from Microsoft now, and it's a new update, a new option for updating on Windows 11 22H2, and it actually started with the build number that you see on screen there. Now, you might not have that build yet. I think it might be the May update will bring you up to at least that build number, but I'm not sure. So the regular monthly update. But once you get to the right build, it is off by default. But if you go to the Windows update in settings, you can enable it. And then the way Microsoft describes it is all future packages are delivered as they roll out. And so if you decide you want faster updates, you can get them through there. And if you decide at a later date that you don't want it, you can toggle that back off and you'll just be back to the regular monthly updates.
Does that mean that you can also get shorter updating sessions because you're getting more frequent updates?
I'm actually not sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. I haven't experienced it yet. I don't know that I actually will, because on the next slide, I just said some other early update options that you actually get. Actually, I think I jumped into a second slide here, but anyway, that's fine. So there are other options to get early updates. So cumulative update previews have been available for the last few years on both Windows 10 and Windows 11, and they are only found by people that are known as seekers by actively going to Settings Windows Update, or in Windows 10, Settings, Update, and Security, Windows Update, and you'll see a list of it like you see here, where I'm being offered 2023-04 cumulative update preview for Windows 11. And in the black box that was on my other machine, I had a cumulative update preview for the .NET framework. So those are two that you will typically see. They will not be foisted on you automatically, but they will be available if you decide you want them. Next. So the question then becomes, should you actually do that? And in the universal answer for all things IT related, that depends. They're not beta updates, so they have been supposedly well tested. There is a chance, I guess, if Microsoft runs into some issues, that they'll fix those issues before the so-called final release goes out for them. But they're not, you're not in an early testing cycle with them. Next. So all preview packages that you see in Windows 10 and 11 as they stand right now, you will eventually get them pushed to your machine. So, you know, do you really want to get them early or not? Next. For the brave, you know, if you always want to have the latest, greatest, sure, go ahead. You're probably not going to have problems with them. But for the rest of us, you know, maybe wait for the final release. You're only going to be, you know, maybe a month till you get this pushed to your machine anyways. So personally, I think I would wait for the final release. I never go for the preview releases on that. But as I say, probably not a problem if you really want them. And that's it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And talking about final releases, this is a news item from quite recent. I think we know that Windows 10 reaches its end of life in 2025, but Microsoft just recently announced that the current version, which is 22H2 of Windows 10, will in fact be the final version. So, as it says, they'll remain in support with security updates, but you won't get other releases. So basically, what they're really saying is that there aren't going to be any more so-called feature updates. So 22H2 is basically what you see is what you get. But you will receive the usual security patches and bug fixes, which is the Patch Tuesday offering typically. And that will continue until end of life. But I think what it tells you is, as usual, Microsoft's encouraging everybody to switch to Windows 11. And the problem with that for some of us is that they haven't changed their hardware requirements. So Windows 11 is really only truly supported on specific CPUs and machines that have a Trusted Platform module. And so if you happen to be like me and you have a fairly recent laptop that has neither of those facilities, then Microsoft says, have a nice day until 2025. Or you can go back to a presentation, a series of presentations I made back in 2021, where I was looking at what I would have to do if I didn't buy a new machine, which would clearly come with Windows 11, stuck with my old computers, which are only good for Windows 10, could I move completely to Windows? So could I move completely away from Windows and only run Linux? So if you have any interest in that, I recommend you take a look at this series. And if you just want to try Linux and see if it's any use to you whatsoever, I've got this series of articles in the newsletter right now, three ways to try Linux. And these are ways that you can try Linux without really affecting your Windows computer at all. For example, this first one is just using a live USB, and the whole Linux system, the operating system and the included apps, everything runs off the USB. It doesn't actually touch your hard drive at all. And the other ways to do it are either running a virtual machine or dual booting. But both of those things really leave your Windows system in its pretty much native state. So if you have any interest in switching to Linux at all, there's certainly ways to do that. Okay, moving along. Chris has got an interesting little item here on market share of various browsers.
Yeah, this is kind of cool. Linda actually came up with this, and she passed it on to me. And so this is a video that goes through 28 years of web browsers showing their market share. So from 1994 to 2022. And I'm going to share a video on this. So here we are at the start of it all, and you can see that Mosaic was the original web browser, and it had 97% of the market share. And then we take it up from there, and then we start to see Netscape coming onto the scene, and it eats Mosaic's lunch in very short order. And by 1996, it has mostly all the share. And then we see Internet Explorer starting to take over, and that was largely, I think, by virtue of the fact that it was included with Windows 95, and we see its market share just continuing to gain at the expense of Netscape. And Netscape shrinking down to almost nothing. Interestingly, we see Opera on the scene way back then, but with a very small market share. And then it grows, but it never grows more than about 2% market share. And then Firefox comes on the scene, and Firefox starts eating the lunch of Internet Explorer. And so we see it growing market share. And because Internet Explorer was the only other browser with reasonable, with any sort of market share, of course, any growth in Firefox is coming at the expense of Internet Explorer. But then we see Chrome coming on the market. And Chrome starts eating the market share, taking it away from both Internet Explorer and Firefox. And you can see Opera there running around. It's 2%. And nice browser, but it never did gain more than about 2%. But we see Chrome continuing to dominate at this point. And we see Edge taking over from Internet Explorer on the Microsoft side, and we see it continuing to shrink a little bit, but it's sticking around the 4%. Firefox is continuing to lose market share, and Chrome continues to dominate for about the last 14 years or so, I guess. It's been dominant in this marketplace. And that's about it. So I thought it was just a cool graphic. I pasted the URL. I ran it about double speed in this demo here. And if you're interested, go to the URL and you can run it and pause it whenever you want to see all of the percentages and so forth.
And Tom wants to know what happened to Lynx.
I guess it never had enough market share to even show up.
Okay, thanks, Chris. That's really neat. I like that.
I think Lynx came before Mosaic. Almost you can't call it a web browser because it was more of a...
Well, it was character mode, eh?
It was mostly character mode, but you could download graphics and stuff. I don't think it had the World Wide Web. It wouldn't display integrated text and pictures. But it was a browser for text.
Okay, moving along. Talking about the Microsoft Store... Here's a little rant from Jeff Dubois. He says, for the most part, it's a digital wasteland with only a modicum of useful apps. But he really likes this program, this app called Cribbage JD. So if you're at all interested in card games and cribbage in particular, this app lets you play by yourself against the computer, or you can play over the internet against an opponent, and the opponent can be just people on the web, or you can actually invite friends to play against you. Jeff says, having played Crib on the farm way back, then this one is a must have. And he makes a note here, it's also cross-platform. So if you want an Android version, the Google Play carries it. And if you know anything about Cribbage, which I know very little, This is an interesting little tidbit from Jeff. He was playing the other morning when he was having coffee, and he found one of these special hands where he has a 28 points in his hand. And the highest score you can get in crib is only 29, which is very rare, he says, and 28 is almost as rare. He's only ever had a 28 hand twice in his life, and his father only had it once. So, you know, neat little anecdote there to go with Cribbage JD. Okay, moving along, you know that I'm interested in programming, and I've talked about using artificial intelligence, ChatGPT in particular, as a programming aid. And I came across this chat bot, which is called Hugging Chat, which is supposedly an open source chat bot. So that, of course, caught my interest. And I went to the website and had a look at it. And it's just like ChatGPT, essentially. They give you a box at the bottom of the homepage there. Type in anything you want, and I'm interested in, can it write Python code for me? So I did the same thing I did with the LibreOffice basic routine I wanted. How do I add a line of text to an ODT file, which is a special kind of zip file? So it basically comes right back, and it's not as detailed as ChatGPT in terms of it doesn't seem to give you a running tutorial on all the various bits and pieces, but it certainly gives you some code, and it kind of tells you what you need to do to install that code. And it looks a bit more complicated than it needs to be, but maybe these are early days, or maybe I asked it a very hard question, I don't know. But it's certainly another option in terms of the AI sphere. One interesting thing was that the original article in ZDNet said that it's an open source technology. But in the comments, this guy called Felix says, well, no, it's not really open source, because the license is actually non-commercial. It's not a GPL type license. So it's kind of freeware, but not really open source as such. But still might be worth a look if you're interested in AI. Okay, moving along. Who's going to talk to this one, Chris?
I think I'm going to talk to it. Stu, if I'm butchering it like I did your other part, jump in. Yeah, so Stuart Bruce came up with this idea, and he's calling it Loony Bits. And he thought that there are many of the technical sites out there, review sites and just product sites and so forth, they describe, you know, latest, greatest and things that are out there, but often they're only available in other parts of the world, typically the U.S., Korea, EU, things like that. And, of course, they'll have pricing that is nowhere near what we'll end up paying in Canada. And so he thought, what if we could share information about these sorts of sites, websites, YouTube channels and so forth, that has information that is aimed directly at Canadians? And so he thought, you know, throw out the challenge. Can you help fulfill our motto, user helping users? And I see here that Alan did not follow my instructions to download the right font. So this would be in the, normally it should be in the font that is used in our actual logo. That's okay. So do you know of any Canadian sites with interesting information and so forth? And you could send them in, and we'll include them in future Q&As. So either you can speak to the items in question, or you can just submit the information and we'll include it in the slide in the future. Next.
Yeah, sorry, Chris. That went right over my head. I thought you were saying that to Stuart. And I didn't realize what you mean. If I had downloaded the font, the PowerPoint slide would have the correct font.
Right? Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. My apologies for that.
This is
the graphic.
Well, yeah, this is going back to my presentation on typography and the dangers of using typefaces and passing on documents to other people that don't have that typeface installed. We ran into it tonight. So Stuart thought, how about if we actually kick it off with three sites? When I've actually got more, but we'll put them into future Q&As. So his first start is these three. So the Government of Canada has an app gallery. And so you can get various things like the weather app from Canada and things like that. And so if you go to that website, you can get all of their mobile apps. Mobile Syrup is a very general news site that's available. And then he had another one, similar one from Apple perspective, so iPhoneincanada.ca. So these are three sites that are aimed directly to Canadians and should have all information that is pertinent to Canadians. So the challenge is that, so if you can send it into a suggestion box at opcug.ca, let us know if you want to speak to the items or if you just want them included on a slide and just to throw it out as a site people can go look at.
And Tom is suggesting Linus Tech Tips, the YouTube channel. Not sure that's completely Canadian.
Well, yeah, it's Canadian based, and I thought about that exact thought crossed my mind when I was on Tech Tips the other day, and he caters more to a U.S. audience. But having said that, in his last the WAN show, he went on a rant about the new bill that is going through Canadian Parliament right now. It has just been enacted, I believe, on content sharing in Canada. So he does have a Canadian flavor to it, but certainly when you look at the pricing, when he talks about pricing, it's usually U.S. prices and things like that. The majority of his audience is actually American, so he does go to that bend. So.
Yeah, that might be another discussion point for us at some point. It seems kind of odd to me that you would try and regulate YouTube to have Canadian content when YouTube is really just a portal whereby all kinds of people can upload content.
Yeah.
Discriminate against Canadians from doing it.
Yeah. Michael Geist at the University of Ottawa has been railing about this for quite a while, saying how this is an absolutely terrible bill that is going through, and it could have far-reaching ramifications. Google has actually threatened to just pull out so that no links would be included in anything that goes out over from Google's search engine because they refused to pay if somebody else. And in some cases, they were saying it was actually news organizations in Canada that are putting links in that encouraging people to go to their website, and then Google's going to have to pay for that? I don't think so. So kind of crazy.
They actually did this in Australia. They cut off for a substantial number of people any indexing of Australian news sites, and they did that for a week or something like that to see what it was like, because the Australian Parliament wants Google to start paying the news websites because they're all running out of money. Also, regarding the bill, supposedly the government is not going to apply this to sort of creator-driven websites like YouTube or TikTok or any of the others. On the other hand, I think they might be interested in affecting the algorithm that points users towards particular items in YouTube or TikTok, as to perhaps giving an extra mark up for Canadian sites for Canadian viewers. But that's not in the bill, and they haven't talked about that.
Yeah, Michael Geis has gone on at some length about the fact that the way the bill is written, it can certainly apply to a lot of things that the government says it doesn't apply to. But he's saying, well, the way you've worded it, yes, it does. You know, so, anyhow.
So, the devil's in the regulations.
Yeah.
Tom is asking whether you can embed fonts into PDF files or PPT PowerPoint files.
Yes, you can. It depends on the font, and I think in a PDF it normally will come through more reliably than in a PPTX file or a DocX file or something like that. And it depends largely on the font file, how it's encoded to show usage rights on it. So fonts can be set up as they are embeddable but not installable, embeddable, installable, embeddable as read-only. There's all kinds of things in there that really throws wrenches into it. I find that in most cases, PDF files actually do a much better job of actually maintaining the font information. And I'm not sure, but I think that in most cases, it's actually doing a graphic in that case, which gives you the fidelity, but it will make the file a bit larger. Of course, embedding fonts makes the file a lot larger too. So.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Another question that came in may be of interest to some people, not others, I should suspect. This is basically somebody who's thinking about installing a custom ROM on an old smartphone, a Galaxy A50. Because, as we all know, Google only supports Android for a certain number of years on any given device. And so one of these days, the security updates on the phone will going to stop. And if you have a custom ROM, you can get security patches still. His question was, first of all, are custom ROMs secure enough if you want to do online banking? And then the second problem was that he couldn't find a ROM for the Galaxy A50 at this particular XDA developer's website. So he looked at various honorable mentions and didn't find out what he wanted. He wants a recommendation for other sites that might have custom ROMs for his phone and something that gives reasonably regular security updates. So the answers to the question I don't really know, I guess, the first one. I guess what I would say is that almost all custom ROMs are based on the Android open source project. Android is an open source software package, and this project gives you the actual source code. So developers take that source code and create their own version, of Android. And create what they call as a custom ROM. So the ROM and the ROM code, because it's an open source project, the ROM code that gets distributed also has to be open source. So the source code is there to be looked at. The question is anybody looking at all the code for all these different custom ROMs? And I've got no idea. And in any case, personally, I'm not big on using Wi-Fi for banking operations. My preference is to use a wired connection, and then HTTPS connection is encrypted, and typically the banks will use two-factor authentication. So it's a pretty secure system if you go that route. So I typically stay away from the wireless. Anyway, going back to the question of custom ROMs. I did look for custom ROM A50 on Google and pulled up a whole bunch of different hits, including the XDA developer's website, but to a more generic page where this website has ROMs for all kinds of different phones, and they're typically grouped by manufacturer and then grouped by model of phone. So this is leading me to a page specific to the A50. And then there will be various posts on there for different developers. So you have to kind of screen the different ROMs and see what you think might be useful. The other thing I've used previously is Lineage OS, which is, an open source an open source project with packages for all kinds of different phones, but not necessarily all phones. And in particular, the A50 doesn't seem to be supported at the current time on Lineage OS. And when you go to one of these sites and you start looking at the different ROMs, what are you looking for? Well, personally, what I do is I look to see, does this developer have a track record? Has he got a lot of postings over time which indicate that there have not been any problems, or if there have been problems, the problems have been fixed, the bug fixes and that kind of thing. And in particular, are there a series of monthly updates? Because this open source project basically produces monthly security patches. So the developer should take that monthly patch and plug it into his custom ROM system, and then you get an over-the-air update on your phone. But the main problem with custom ROMs is that it's freeware, and it's only going to be available, A, if a developer owns the phone that you're using, and B, it's only really useful if that ROM is maintained. And what I find when I look at a track record of historical postings, what I find is that lots of developers start a project, they run it for a little while, and then suddenly it stops, and that software is kind of abandoned. So that's a useless ROM in my particular opinion. And then the other thing about ROMs is that if you're going to play with it, A, you have to find out what's required, because typically you might have to have a backup system, a backup software installed. You have to know, you might have to unlock the bootloader on your phone. You have to know how to actually install a ROM. And all this stuff is not necessarily straightforward. So again, you've got to look for people that have done it, know how to do it, the developers themselves, how-to tutorials, video tutorials, and hope that you can find a custom ROM that you like with information on how to install it that's easy to understand. So I've said it lots of times, it's a really neat system, but it's not for the faint of heart. So take that as you may. But by the same token, I hate the idea that a perfectly good piece of hardware gets thrown away because Google decided they're not going to support security patches for it any longer. That's outrageous. Anyway, moving along. Here's a question that came in today about Facebook Messenger. And the problem I have is I don't use Facebook and I don't use Messenger, and I don't think Chris uses either very much.
No, I don't.
So we don't know the answer. So the problem is, Marjorie opens Messenger either with Facebook or using the app, and a screen pops up saying, we're running security checks and it's going to take a while. And then it changes to, oh, now you need to create a PIN for end-to-end encrypted chats. And soon we're going to make these encrypted, and then you'll need a PIN to get them back. Now, at this point, the only options are to create the PIN or go to advanced options. And Marjorie can't get past this screen unless she gets a message coming in from somebody else. So the question is to anybody who knows, is this a legitimate ask? Marjorie didn't ask for the PIN, and she didn't really want to have her chats encrypted. Or she didn't ask for it anyway. And she's particularly concerned about it because this whole business seemed to begin when she was using Wi-Fi when she was away in Costa Rica. And she was using Messenger with someone who she says their security is less than robust. And today these screens have popped up on Facebook when she tried to send a Facebook memory to a friend. But on Facebook, she can get back to her main Facebook page and continue going, but can't do that on Messenger. So since Chris and I don't know the answer, the question is, does anybody on the call or know anybody who uses Facebook and Messenger and knows the answer to these questions? Are you seeing this? Stuart says, my best buddy here says she's never seen that screen. So that's not... That doesn't bode well. I don't know what that means. And Tom's suggesting use WhatsApp. Well, if you're if you're a Facebook aficionado, I suspect that's not a viable option. Alison says she uses Messenger and has never seen that screen either. So you might want to check into that some more, Marjorie, and try and find out where these messages are coming from. Okay, we'll keep monitoring the chat and see if anybody has anything else useful. But in the meantime, we have a share here from Bob Harris, and Bob's going to share his screen and chat to his slides.
And he's going to unmute himself.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you. I think we're here now, and we're live now.
Perfect.
Hey, so I'm sure you all love typing. Ooh, my window is here. So how are your keyboard skills? Do you all type very quickly? Do you use all your fingers? Or maybe you're a keyboard ninja. But I'm not. I could spend days and hours practicing my keyboard skills until my fingers cramp up and on. But another choice is simply activate Windows speech recognition. If you use Windows, you don't have to type everything. You do have choices and options. There's no software to install. Windows speech recognition. This is my desk with my desktop microphone. There's other reasons to get a headset. I'll talk about that later. But you press the button and away you type. It's easy. I'll show you how. Microphones are very affordable. I don't suggest mine, but consider getting a headset if you want to do this. They're not expensive. Setting it up is really simple. There's no software to download. It's all built into Windows. Simply type Windows speech recognition into your Windows search, your control panel, etc. And just follow the prompts. It'll pick your headset, whether you want a desktop or a headset microphone. Set it up. In seconds, you'll be doing it. If you want to come back to the setup screen, tip is Windows key Control S. Go back in there and set up whatever you want to do to again. You can change stuff in later on, but it's easy to do. So your microphone's all set up. You turn it on. This is my memory trick here. You want Windows to hear. I want Windows to hear me. So I press the Windows key and H. That's my memory trick for H. Windows H will activate the speech recognition. So the mic's on, Windows key and H. You'll know if Windows is listening. There's two symbols or little icons, boxes show up. Windows 10, Windows 11. Now there's an endless list of commands. You can control your whole PC with this, your whole document. I don't do any of that. I use my keyboard still. I use my mouse still. But I use it to enter text. Sometimes I'll say enter a new sentence or a new paragraph. That's what all I use it for. So let's go for a test drive. I'll have to change some windows here. Stand by, please. I got to go into WordPerfect. This will work equally well in Gmail or anything else. So you should see my WordPerfect screen here now, I hope.
Yep.
So the microphone is turned on right now. I'm going to press Windows H. And hope you can see the font here. This is how you type with a microphone. As you can see, it's very easy to do. As you can see, it's very easy to do. I have to lean a little bit forward to make it work properly. So I suggest you purchase a headset microphone. Keep turning it off by mistake here. Headset microphone will allow you to keep a very consistent distance from your mouth to the microphone. I've discovered when I'm using the microphone, I can instantly and correctly spell almost any word. The marvelous chef used her ambidextrous skills to eagerly sprinkle Worcestershire sauce with both hands. Oh, Worcestershire. Worcestershire.
Worcestershire. Worcestershire.
Worcestershire sauce. Anyway, it does work well. I can go on and on. I still use a keyboard and stuff. And that's about all I got for this anyway. It's easy to do. Cool. The software is built in. Have fun.
I noticed that you didn't have to say period at the end of a sentence. It seemed to do that automatically when you pause for a while.
It does, and most commas. Like you can go back to certain words. There's a myriad of commands you can learn. I never bothered with that. I use my keyboard still and my mouse. But for the bulk of the text, I can throw it in there quickly. And I have a microphone now for my, you see it here, and plus one operating now for my Zoom camera. So two microphones here are a bit of a myriad of stuff. But anyway, it works well.
Well, you and I must have had a misspent youth there, Bob. Tristan says that typing was the most useful class he ever had in high school. Tom says between grades 8 and 9, he went to summer school to learn touch typing. Stuart's still trying to find the darned any key. Tim got up to 30 to 35 words a minute in grade 9. And Tim wants to know, does it do Canadian spelling? So do you get labor or labor?
I don't know.
I'm presuming that is depends on the language pack you have in Windows and what the default language is for Windows, I would presume.
Yeah, I would think so too.
Exactly, yes.
If you're really in a bind about touch typing, there are a variety of typing games that you can download and use, and they measure how and you kind of play Space Invaders by typing different keys. And they really do give your hands and your fingers a workout using all 10 fingers. So, well, all 8 because the thumb is usually used for the space bar.
So Bill says you can do the same thing in Android using the Google keyboard. It has a microphone icon.
And exactly, yes.
I'll have to swipe that idea.
And Elizabeth says that she uses a microphone on iPhone to message and search. And it avoids the on-screen keyboard on an iPhone. I should think, yeah, the little phone, that's not so good.
Yeah, Google
stuff.
Androids are very good for taking notes because you can just talk into them and it's very quick, at least on my Pixel.
And it's also remarkable how accurate the translation is, given that we've got such tiny little smartphones. Incredible processing power these days.
Yes.
Okay, we just hit the magic last 10, so we're open for questions or discussion or anything people would like to share. I don't know if I missed anything in the chat there.
Yeah, we did have something back. B posted that her daughter, who teaches English at university, asked me to bring up the whole subject of chatbot as a substitute for original thought and writing as a possible topic. Now, I don't know if that's something that we can cover off in any sort of substance tonight.
Yeah, no, I think she was wondering if that was something that you guys had any thoughts on. Maybe not, maybe as a topic that you might tackle at some other point. And she would be sure to join in. It's quite an issue if you're an English teacher and your students are all using chatbot to write their essays, and exams. And the other thing was also apparently it's being used for the application processes, you know, so writing applications to the university. And of course that creates a problem because the people who can afford technology have yet another advantage over the disadvantaged who don't have all of those fancy things. So it introduces some interesting philosophical questions. And are there going to be, first of all, the philosophical question of if the chatbot writes your essay, is that your essay? And secondly, are they going to actually produce efficient or accurate counter programs so that the teacher can figure out who wrote it?
Yeah, I do know that I've read a couple of watched a couple of interviews where there are some teachers who are actually embracing it, and they figure, well, it's going to be used anyways, so you know, let's. And I'm not sure what their solution is to make sure that it is used, you know, in a more ethical manner, I guess, where you know you're not trying to claim that this is your original thought. Personally, I haven't gone into that an awful lot. There are some attempts being made, I know, to identify things that are created by GPT chat, chat GPT and things like that. I don't know how successful those are.
Mm-hmm. She was shocked to find that the intake people who review the applications were actually suggesting to students that they use chatbot to write their application.
Yeah.
And she thought, like,
that's probably to make sure that they can understand what's being written.
I guess.
It's a really interesting question, though. It's actually been suggested at the board that we have a whole monthly meeting based on chatbots. The question is, does anybody know of a speaker who could speak to it intelligently?
Yeah.
That's what we really need. I mean, we can have an open discussion, but kind of the blind leading the blind, I think.
I suggest that actually,
I think each of us could actually use ChatGPT or Bard or Discover, Discover and Edge, Bard and Google. And actually use it to create something and then have a meeting where we present all these things. I did a few things. I had a rhyming poem praising a bridge, contract bridge. It's a fun kind of thing. And it might be an idea to kind of show what you did and then how you got to where it is and just share that, because I think it's a variety of uses that is more important than any particular use.
And the other issues with this stuff are, A, there's a whole rack of these things coming on board all of a sudden, and B, is everybody going to start charging the earth for them?
Yeah. Yeah, apparently it's taking up a huge amount of processing power on the back end to actually answer these stupid little queries that are being thrown to it at an increasing pace. And so there's an awful lot of computing power being chewed up by these for free at this point. But Yeah, it's something I think we should look into doing something more in-depth somehow on that.
Yeah, I agree. We'll take that under advisement. Yeah.
Okay, that was all she was asking.
In the chat from Elle Boulay. She has a quick question about logging off. Can you expand on that for us, please?
Yes, hi. It's me. So we're going to very, very, very high tech to very, very low tech. When I log off, I sometimes, you know, when I'm something Facebook or whatever, email, and I say, darn, I forgot to log off. So I go back, you know, and then I do proper log off. If I don't log off, what happens? Is there security risk for not logging off something, logging out or logging off something?
Alan, you want to take a crack at it or?
No, how about you?
there's a couple of nuances to this, I guess. If you don't log off, then if you're in a browser, your browser's remembering your credentials. When you go back on, you probably didn't have to log in again. So the browser understood that you were still logged into that service. And just brought you back to wherever you were before in it. So there's one danger, I guess, in that if there is malware or something, somebody comes onto your computer, then the browser still knows you as being logged into there. That's probably not the best thing. So logging out ensures that if there is somebody who has compromised your computer and tries to access Facebook or Gmail or whatever it is you happen to be logged into, they won't get back into it because they'll be presented with the login prompt. Having said that, if somebody has got that level of access that they can compromise things, you probably are in a position where you have more to worry about than just your Facebook or Gmail or whatever. By and large, personally, I don't really care an awful lot about logging out of services. I typically don't log out of services, and one of the reasons is so that I don't have to log back in if I fire it up again, be it my Gmail or whatever. And most of the time, most of the services, that would even survive a reboot. And you go back into your browser and it'll understand who you are already. So from a convenience point of view, not logging out is a good idea. From a security point of view, it's probably not the best. The best would be to do a logout, but the likelihood of compromise, I think, is pretty low, but I'm willing to entertain an argument against that from anybody on the call. If you think that this is a really bad thing to leave yourself logged in and just close your browser or whatever, please chime in.
Actually, Jeff's supporting your position here. He says logging off is not an issue if your computer is not used by another person,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah.
Chris, that you were going to tell me depends. I thought that was just black and white.
It's true. And that idea of whether somebody else is using your computer is important as well, right? Because, I live alone, so nobody else is going to walk up to my keyboard and do something, you know, as me. If you do have other people in the house and you want to ensure that that doesn't happen accidentally or otherwise, then logging out would be actually a good thing. Walking away from your keyboard, hitting Windows and L to lock it is not a bad idea. That way, you know, as long as you haven't shared your password, then nobody else can go in and do things as you. So all those sort of things, that depends. It's a trust thing. If you have multiple people in the household and things like that, do you trust those people? That they're not going to do malicious things.
Thank you very much.
Harvey's pointing out that some services, such as CIBC Banking, will actually time out your session.
That's true, yes. Most banking sessions, I think, should. And I'm just trying to think. I think every one that I use does time out after, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes of inactivity. And that's a really good thing for them to do that. But most other services like Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, they'll never time you out.
Interesting thing. One of the risks is if an active session can be, an active session token can be hijacked. And many high profile YouTubers have been hacked through that way. But he says the risk is relatively low if you're not a high profile internet user.
But you can also,
by several extensions, make all of your cookies a session cookie, which disappears at the end of the session, or which disappears after the page has been closed, in which case you're effectively logged out and the session cookie will be gone, as well as the cookie for that service. And you'd always have to log on again when you actually started up that particular website. But that would be one way to give you a little bit more security if you're worried about your cookies being reused, if someone could get into your computer either locally or remotely.
Yeah, that's a good point. And one easy way to do that, I guess, would be just do an in-private browsing session.
Yep, you can do that in private, or what do they call it? Ignoramus,
incognito?
Or something like that. Yeah, ignoramus.
Ignoramus. Yeah. Yeah.
Incognito, and do your Facebook stuff in that, and then when you exit that, you'll have to log in again when you actually restart Facebook or whatever site you're going to.
Yeah. So Firefox calls it a private window. Chrome calls it an incognito window. Edge calls it a in-private window. If you run the browser in any of those, it doesn't keep session cookies going and things like that. So when you close the browser, it forgets it all.
So we've hit the magic hour that we schedule for these things. So I guess we'll move on to wrap up. But I just ask people, do you have any interest in the idea of a chatbot and sharing things that it does? And send us a note on what you'd like to share, and we'll see if we can put together a whole bunch of stuff. And certainly if you know anybody that knows anything useful about artificial intelligence systems and would be prepared to provide something for a major meeting, then we'd like to hear about that too. Anyway, in the meantime, let's just move on to next week. Next week is our regular club meeting on May the 10th. So if you have anything you'd like to share, relatively to short presentation, anything computer related, we'd like to hear from you. And I just give a plug here. I am going to have a presentation on artificial intelligence and programming. And I'll talk a little bit about the bots that are available to do that and what good things they can do in that line of work. But because it's a regular meeting, there's no Q&A session next week, so you have a couple of weeks now to get all those questions in and think about topics that you'd like to share and put something together for our meeting on May the 17th. So we've covered a whole raft of different things. I hope it's been pretty interesting. I certainly found some of the things really interesting. So I hope everybody enjoyed it, and hopefully we'll see you next week at the Members' Favorites meeting.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.